This digital recording comes from the New Energy Times Archive.
There we go. Well, I'd like to talk about two subjects this morning. The first, I'd like to describe a list of criteria that I believe should be applied to any theory. And any theory that is to be trusted must meet. And the second thing I'd like to discuss is a model that's mostly focused on the nuclear environment that, in fact, does meet these criteria. Well, to start, the first criteria, I believe, is that any thought process must be consistent with the correctly observed behavior of all kinds. Many theoreticians love to pick and choose, but I don't think that's wise at this point. There's so much experimental evidence that's available that it's very possible to make a consistent view with what's known. Transmutation is an incredibly powerful tool in arriving at some insights. And that's been ignored by a lot of people, mainly because it's almost impossible to explain. The process must be consistent with well-established behavior observed in other fields. Cohesion is not an isolated phenomenon. It's part of nature. And therefore, whatever we propose happens in cohesion must be seen and explainable in other fields of science. For example, cohesion is a spontaneous reaction. All spontaneous reactions are exothermic. There's two parts to the cohesion reaction. There's the nuclear part, which is obviously exothermic, but there's also the part that creates the environment in which the nuclear reactions must occur, or it has to be there for them to occur. That process must also, the creation of that process must also be exothermic. Now, some theories love to imagine energy being concentrated in certain areas of the labs. Well, first of all, energy resists going uphill, so you're fighting nature. That's not a good idea. But if you concentrate energy in a lattice, you have to do it in some manner. That is, the atoms have to vibrate more strongly. Electrons have to be pushed to a higher energy level. Things are changed in that environment, which will affect the chemistry of that environment. And the chemical processes will soak up the energy before you get anywhere near the ability to make the reaction occur. And also, if you make an isotope by the LANR process, that isotope will have all the characteristics known that that isotope has in the real world. In other words, it is radioactive. In the real world, it will be radioactive as a result of being made by the Goldfield process. Now let's move on and look at the evidence for the cluster formation. The Inamura work was not the only evidence that clusters were involved, but it's the most clean, the most easily observed, most easily understood. And barium takes up, as it takes up deuterium and makes samarium, it's very clear that those deuterium must go into the lattice simultaneously. You can't have it happen one at a time. So it's a very clear evidence for cluster formation. We'll show some other data later that is also consistent with that. But the thing that's very interesting about this that can be revealed in this equation by the selection mark, we have a tremendous amount of energy being given off by this reaction. That energy go? How does it communicate it to the environment? That has not been really addressed in theory. We're proposing that the cluster is large enough so that some of the clusters left over. In this particular case, six would go into the barium and make samarium, and there might be 10 more deuterons left over that scatter in all directions once the cluster is decomposed by the formation of samarium, and thereby carry away the energy. So this is another sort of a novel idea, about 10 years ago by George Miley. There's been a lot of data reported. Miley data is particularly great because it's very complete. It was done over a broad spectrum of elements. It was also done by a number of techniques to measure the concentration. But what he has plotted here is the rate of reaction, which is proportional to the number of that of the isotopes or the elements that are present in the sample, against mass number. Well, transmutation requires a target. What targets are apt to be in that sample, in the catalyst of the electrolytic cell? Well, there was palladium present, and we'll put palladium where it would fall on this graph. Nickel was present, we'll put it there. He used lithium sulfate as the electrolyte, so some sulfur would be present, lithium. Platinum was the anode, you know that anode material transfers to the cathode, and so some platinum was present. So let's look at this in a little bit more detail. We see, first of all, that to the right of these targets are a collection of elements of significant concentration. To the left, there's practically nothing. And that range drops off very abruptly. So there's a region of isotopes that exists on the high side. Notice that also with palladium, on the high side, there's quite a range of 20 mass units, and then an abrupt drop, indicating that clusters of various sizes have gone into the abyss of palladium, causing a variety of isotope weights for masses. You see that same thing in sulfur, although it's not quite as wide. It's a little different in nickel. On the high side, the obvious consequence of transmutation, there's this range, which will be others, but also there's a bunch on the low side. It happens that this is in the iron region of the periodic table, which is very stable from a nuclear point of view. And that has exactly half the mass of these. So it appears that these materials, as transmutation occurs, some of them fission into fragments that fall in this region. But let's look at this in more detail to see just exactly what's happening to cause these transmutation reactions. If you add a neutron, which some theories have proposed is the added material, you increase the atomic weight by a unity each time you add one neutron. Change the atomic number, which is this direction. These little dots correspond to the stable isotopes, so the true reproducibility of the elements. In order to go from this element, for example, which would be the target nickel in this case, you have to release an electron. That's beta emission. These are all beta emitters. They have half lives from minutes to milliseconds to microseconds. And so, two things you would expect to see if the neutrons were involved. First of all, you would see delayed emission. Well, you don't see that. Second of all, it would take time for this beta decay daughter sequence to move up to the stability regions where the atoms that are measured chemically lie. We don't see that. So, obviously, neutrons are not involved. What if protons are involved? This was a white blood cell, and so you would expect protons to be involved. But if you look at the consequence of adding protons, you can only add protons up to 3 in the case of nickel, and up to about 4 in the case of 5 in the case of palladium, before you leave the stability region and enter the region of radioactivity, where we know we don't enter because we don't see the radioactive material. So protons cannot be the cause of that sequence that Miley has measured. On the other hand, if you look at deuterons, you can add deuterons up to quite a few up to here before it leaves the stability region, and in the case of palladium, up here before it leaves the plate. And it turns out that the width of this region is the And the deuterons form clusters preferentially over protons. Otherwise, we should have seen the proton effect, but we don't, even though there's lots of protons in that system. There's only a few deuterons. Those few deuterons are doing all the work. All right, what conclusions can we arrive at here? Well, neutrons are not involved in transmutation, so that eliminates that group theory. Protons are not included in the full range of transmutation products. They might have a few, but the full range that are measured are not produced by protons. At least 10 deuterons can make a cluster and enter the nucleus of palladium. And based upon our previous conclusion about how the energy is dissipated, those clusters have to be significantly bigger than 10. So what role does a cluster play in producing fusion, and where are these clusters formed? But we have to go back now, leave the transmutation, and go to the fusion side of the equation. Michael Kubri found this equation and showed that the excess power is related to a term that has concentration squared, so the effect of sensing concentration. This is a term having to do with applied current, because it's a wavelet cell, which affects the composition of the surface. And this is a term that has to do with flux. And I would like to expand this first term into two parts. This would be the concentration of the nuclear active environment, that is, that region of the material that is needed to support the nuclear reaction, and the effect times efficiency. The surface or the material is not uniform, so we have to take that into account. Well, he says that the greatest was the deuterium content is largest. That's pretty obvious. Where is it largest? Well, and in a constellation cell, it's largest on the surface. Not only from first principles, but actual measurements have shown us that the surface composition is higher in the interior. It also happens that the surface of nanoparticles are very rich in absorbed deuterium when we're in a deuterium environment. So those would be the two reasons that you would expect would be the place where the nuclear reactions are occurring, and that's where you should look. Now, it's also true that the deuterium in the surface, this concentration was the average fault, but we've established that all the reactions are on the surface. What does the surface composition look like? Well, it turns out, and I don't have time to go into the reasons behind it, but the surface composition will be much more sensitive to the bulk composition than a square term. So it probably is much higher term here, especially here at unity. So the near unity of the surface composition is changing very, very rapidly. And that accounts for the sensitivity of the effect as we get near unity. The role of the flux is uncertain. It may be only something that's related to how the composition is being changed. Okay, the logical consequences, we'll go past that. The role of nanoparticles. Nanoparticles are everywhere. I mean, thanks to the work of Barada, pure nanoparticles are clearly active. But also, you can identify the presence of nanoparticles in every single environment that has supported cold fusion. And so it's not a big left leap of faith to say that nanoparticles are universal. And so we would propose that physical form and size of the nanoparticles may act as a template for the formation of clusters. That's attractive because these clusters are so large, they can't form in a lattice. They can't form in defects. They would have to be rather large defects. But they can form on the surface of nanoparticles. So the proposed conclusions are that many theories can be eliminated. In fact, as I would suggest, perhaps 99% of theories. I'll give a few of you a little bit of a environment are consistent with all observations, and so it would be wise for the theory to focus on those two characteristics. Large clusters are part of it, and they shield the Coulomb barrier. They have to do two things. They have to shield the Coulomb barrier, even though it's a very large structure. And once it's shielded, of course, it finds a new neuron, it fuses, it finds a part of how adder goes to test transportation. In either case, the extra deuterons carry away the energy. And so the transmutation and fusion are symmetrical processes originating from the same basic material, that is, these two clusters. And the clusters form on the surface of nanoparticles are complex protein molecules. I mean, there are some people that believe this happens in light. The Russians have shown that very convincingly, that transmutation can occur by bacteria. So I would suggest that future work plus focus on this, and the two diagnostics, these bacteria that go flying in all directions as a result of decomposition of the cluster, some of them will be ionized and some of them won't. A ionized energetic particle goes through matter a different way than a non-ionized one. And so we'll have a mixture of characteristics that has to be probably sought on purpose. So one should look for energetic, but not really energetic, neutrons, and look for weak X-rays that would result from their interaction with matter. And these X-rays would be fairly weak and fairly hard to see. But those should be the main diagnostics, and that our approach focuses on that as a way of perhaps getting more useful information. Okay, thank you very much.
Gentlemen, because we had a session devoted to a theory just afterward, I suggest that the question might be discussed at this occasion. So I propose